Welcome to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. House Bill 2002, Transforming Justice 2021, a bill now before the Oregon Legislature, is the work of a broad coalition of organizations led by Partnership for Safety and Justice. It is a response to the urgent call to transform our public safety system and address structural racism that is at the root of our criminal justice system. We'll hear from Partnership for Safety and Justice Executive Director Andy Coe, Deputy Director Shannon White, and others as they discuss House Bill 2002, Senate Bill 401, and other criminal justice reform legislation. Find out more about these bills and contact your Oregon legislators at oregonlegislature.gov.
Welcome to today's webinar. I'm Talia Gadd, Communications Director at Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're going to focus on our priority bills for 2021, talk about four different policy proposals. All right, Babak, we're going to start with you. Babak is a community healing initiative family care manager for POIC and Rosemary Anderson High School. Can you talk about Measure 11 and share some of your experience, perspectives, and insight with us?
I've been seeing for years how Measure 11 has been tearing families apart generation after generation. And in looking at Measure 11, which if you look at the numbers, you know, 4 out of 10 people in prison in Oregon are there for a Measure 11 conviction, and many more are there for crimes where they pled out of Measure 11, right? It's very clear that when folks are facing these mandatory minimum sentences where judges don't have discretion over their case and can't look at several factors to make sentencing decisions, that folks then are taking plea deals because they don't trust the system, right? They're not ready to go to trial to try to fight their case. They end up looking at the number of years that they're facing, right? Which is 5 years, 10 months at a minimum, day for day, no opportunity to earn time off their sentence. And they end up taking deals. So that 4 in 10 is a big number, right? 40% of our prisons are with folks who have Measure 11 convictions, but many more are there for Measure 11 charges. So, you know, the key piece for reform would be giving judges an opportunity to use their discretion to make sentencing decisions, right? Allow them to do their job. Let judges be judges, right? Oregonians support that. They support having judges use their discretion rather than having all that power with the prosecutor, right? And with the district attorney's office. The other piece then is also that we stop focusing on shaming people and thinking that that's going to help people become better folks, especially when they return to the community, and actually have a culture of internal accountability where folks are really looking at what they did, being honest with themselves, and are invested in their growth, right? That's really good for policy. It's a win-win for folks to come back to our community and be safe neighbors, right? I'd much rather have someone who I would feel safer, and ask yourself if you would feel safer with someone who earned time off their sentence because they were doing really well and engaged in services and investing in themselves versus someone who was just crossing out dates on a calendar, waiting for that day to come home with no incentive to do better upon that return. These are just some of the areas that are key to Measure 11 reform.
People who have been following our work know that originally the Measure 11 reform was a part of House Bill 2002. That is one of Partnership for Safety and Justice's priority legislation, which Shannon's going to talk more about. Can you talk a little bit about why that was amended out and what we should be looking for over the last couple of months of the legislative session?
Absolutely, Talia. And House Bill 2002, it's a big, ambitious bill with a lot of layers of the criminal justice system, including policing and reentry services, parole and probation. And, you know, Measure 11 was originally in there. And whether it's in our bill or not, like the racial justice piece of this was really critical for House Bill 2002 and any other bills really that are out there right now in the aftermath of the protests over the summer after George Floyd was murdered. You know, you look at the statistics in Oregon, you've got 2% of the state population is Black, yet 10% of the prison population in Oregon is Black, right? That's 5 times the rate, right? And Measure 11 fuels that, right? We talked earlier about how 4 in 10 people in Oregon's prisons are there for Measure 11 and many more for plea deals that they took. So start as Measure 11 charges. So it's key to recognize that this is a racial justice bill, and it's really focused on the over-incarceration and the over-policing of people of color. We did have Measure 11 in there and reforms originally. We decided to focus our efforts on Measure 11 with Senate Bill 401, which is one of the bills that focuses on ending mandatory minimum sentencing and allowing judges to use sentencing as the Measure 11 sentences, presumptive sentences. We thought it would be best to really recognize, in order for us to move forward with some of our initiatives in House Bill 2002, that would be best served to not have Measure 11 in there. And the reason why is because of Measure 10, which passed when Measure 11 passed, which means that any reforms to Measure 11 would take a two-thirds supermajority vote in the legislature. And if Measure 11 was in our bill in 2002, that it would take a two-thirds vote to pass that whole bill. You can't just pass part of the bill two-thirds and then do a simple majority, like, you know, 51% on the other part. It would take a two-thirds vote. So we're investing our support and energy around Senate Bill 401 and hoping that we can both support that to get reform around Measure 11, but also to support the different pieces of our bill, which I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Shannon White is our Deputy Director at Partnership for Safety and Justice with over 20 years of experience transforming criminal justice and public safety systems. Shannon, really for the better part of a year, you have been really deeply involved in House Bill 2002. And as some of our advocates may know, this legislative proposal was developed by a big coalition that you've been a part of. Community-based and racial equity partners have been at the heart of that. Can you talk about the coalition, about the bill's development, and about the range of pretty exciting proposals that are in it?
Yeah, I think as everyone knows, and Babak just mentioned, George Floyd's murder last spring, the Black Lives Matter movement last fall really, I think, pushed all of us to dig deeper, to try and do more than we'd ever done before. And in that moment, we at Partnership for Safety and Justice also recognized that we needed to do our work differently. So we partnered with Latino Network initially and then pulled together a diverse coalition to develop some comprehensive responses to criminal justice, because so much focus was happening and great work being done around policing. But we know policing is just the beginning of the system, right? That's like the entry point, but then it's so much bigger in other parts as well. And so we worked with people who often work on criminal justice policy, like the ACLU and criminal defense lawyers, but also in partnering with Latino Network or organizations like Sponsors, which is a reentry program in Eugene, really started centering communities that were the most impacted by over-policing and over-incarceration and people who have lived experience with that system. We also work with Black and Indigenous and other people of color-led organizations like Flip the Script and Red Lodge Transitions, which are both culturally specific reentry programs, the Coalition of Communities of Color, and Imagine Black. And, you know, the work felt really critical when we started meeting last August to pull together this really comprehensive and ambitious bunch of reforms. And as Babak said, some of them has fallen off because I think sometimes when you do things really fast and big, you can't get it all over the finish line the first time. So we still have, I do think, the most meaningful, the most deeply rooted in community bill, but not all of it that we hoped for in the beginning is going to be in the final version. It's also worth mentioning that the work we did has now been combined with the work of a governor's Racial Justice Council's Subcommittee on Criminal Justice. They had developed some priorities as well, and legislative leadership asked that those priorities get merged with our priorities. So what I'm going to talk about today covers both those bills, which are now combined in House Bill 2002. And just broadly speaking, before we go into deeper dives about the bill, I think it's helpful to think about the kind of buckets of work that we did. So the first bucket is limiting when police officers can even stop someone. Like, we limit in 2002 that police can't just stop you for having a single taillight out or for failing to turn, because we know these are the moments where Black and Brown folks end up getting hurt, killed, or just humiliated. And so we look at limiting when police can arrest people or stop people and taking out those low-level crimes and just saying, we've got to have a different community response. We don't want police doing that anymore. We are also looking at shrinking and transforming the culture of probation and post-prison supervision. And I'll talk more later about why that's important for us. And then the other bucket is community investments. Like, one, the biggest problem around safety is the lack of investment in communities that need it most. We know that there has been historical systemic racism that has led to the underinvestment, particularly in communities of color, and we have to get resources into those communities so they can be safe and strong and people can be healthy and thriving. So we're going to now pivot to a video about arrest, the arrest and stop section of our bill.
Hello, my name is Shawnee Harris Bagwell. I am the political director of Imagine Black. We are an organization that helps Portland's Black community imagine the alternatives we deserve. I'm going to take you on a trip that shouldn't be very exciting. Let's pretend I'm a young Black woman coming home from work or on my way to school when I see lights behind me. I panic and start questioning myself. I wasn't speeding. I broke no laws. My car's in good shape. My registration's up to date. And I'm now being told by an officer that my taillight's out and they're asking for my license and registration. So I reach to grab it from the glove box and I'm suddenly being told at gunpoint to exit the vehicle and I'm being violently arrested for resisting arrest. I think, what have I done to deserve this? What am I being arrested for? Why is this happening to me? The confusion and the terror are overwhelming and all too common when traffic stops are the primary reason for contact with a police officer. Or I could be a young Black woman who's just been released from prison and am under supervision. So I'm making money the only ways that I know how to and am working when I'm jumped. I'm robbed, assaulted, I'm hurt, I'm physically hurt. And I'm scared. Who can I call for help? Do I report it? Or should I ask, why don't I call the police? It's because I'm under supervision and any contact with police will lead to my arrest. So I suffer in fear and silence. What we're aiming to do with this bill is limit the contact people have with the police and limit the reasons police can physically connect with civilians. This bill would mean that the police can't stop you for a broken headlight, taillight, brake light, or expired registration. It would mean that police no longer have those excuses to stop women like Sandra Bland or men like Philando Castile. This bill also means that prostitution, criminal trespass, resisting arrest, and interfering with a police officer will no longer be arrestable offenses. This will be a huge step forward in tackling racial profiling and racial disparities in arrest. If we look at the current justice system like a giant skyscraper-sized Jenga tower made of heavy steel beams, it's hard to topple. But this is our opportunity to take a piece. And that paves the way for us to take another piece until we can weaken the foundation and reuse those pieces to build a structure that supports us all.
So that's the next bucket that I'll talk a little bit about is community investments and what House Bill 2002 does to invest in communities, particularly communities of color. So the first thing it does is take a pot of money that many of you have joined with us in advocating for the Justice Reinvestment Initiative funds and allocates 20% of that to go to culturally specific services. So these are services that are serving Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and other people of color around the state. Because we know right now, those programs aren't getting the resources they need. They often are so underfunded, they just don't have access to these pots of big money. And so this money would go through the Northwest Health Foundation, who would work with small community-based programs to build up their infrastructure and capacity to get these bigger grants and to build up their capacity to do more work and serve more people. And it just couldn't be more important when you think about when people are in need of services that are critical and life-saving, you know, whether those are victim services, whether that's mental health, addiction treatment, to get that treatment in your first language with people who understand your culture is just critical to success. And if we aren't funding that, we think it is a primary driver of why people of color are disproportionately in the system is because we're not developing the alternatives, honestly, that white people are benefiting from. So 20% of justice reinvestment funds would go to culturally specific services. The other piece, and this actually came from the governor's Racial Justice Council bill, is a $10 million investment in restorative justice programs. So these are, I think folks know, like alternatives to sort of typical punishment practices that we use for accountability right now, and to fund some existing programs, but also to develop more responses to restorative justice. In case people aren't familiar with restorative justice, and I know it kind of sounds like justice reinvestment, so many justice, I pulled this definition I wanted to read just so folks who don't maybe know restorative justice would have a working definition. This one came from Resolutions Northwest, a local program that says restorative justice is a valuable alternative to exclusionary practices when community problems occur. It seeks to restore community and repair harm while holding all involved accountable. Restorative justice is not a prescribed program, but a philosophy based on community building and repairing harm. Restorative justice is kind of one of the most beautiful models available to really address harm and to create more healing. Finally, this bill would allocate about $1.5 million to Reimagine Safety, which is a Black-led effort to create alternative solutions to public safety. And so this was really developed right after the Black Lives Matter movement, an Oregon-based effort, and our bill would allocate money to fulfill their ultimate of $2.5 million goal to really be able to have the time to do the research, the planning, and the studying of what kind of public safety solutions would really work, because we know those are complex and there are multitudes of solutions. There is not a single solution. And so many public officials are saying to the Black community in particular, what are your answers? And folks need time to study it, research it, and Black community in particular and BIPOC community in general haven't been given the resources and the time and the space and the research opportunities to do that work. So House Bill 2002 would be supporting that effort.
Can you give a little bit more detail about what would change in traffic stops? Like what would look different in terms of what 2002 is proposing?
Yeah, so generally both with traffic stops and arrests, the officer could still provide a citation for someone, but they would need to not stop them. So if they can see that you didn't have a turn signal, they could take your license plate and they could still send you a ticket for failing to turn or send me the ticket. And when it comes to arrests, similarly, an officer cannot arrest someone for some of these lower level crimes. So some of these crimes that we targeted, for example, are criminal trespass. And this is a place often where people who are experiencing houselessness get arrested just to move the person. And this is basically saying the officer cannot take that person to jail. They're going to have to figure out another way to handle if that person is in a business's doorstep, because we don't need that person experiencing the trauma of jail, of being separated from their property, of being locked up. And so these are the kinds of things where essentially it's like that person could still be given a ticket for being there, for committing that crime of houselessness, if you want to call it that, but would no longer be able to be taken to jail.
Julianne Jackson, she's Partnership for Safety and Justice's Movement Building Director. Years of experience advancing racial and economic justice locally and across the state. So we've been talking about Measure 11. We've been talking about House Bill 2002. An area that you've been particularly focused on is around crisis response teams. Can you talk about why this is an area of passion and focus for you? Like, what brings you to this kind of area of interest?
Yeah, I think, you know, we know that 1 in 50 Americans are struggling with mental health diagnoses. We know that at least 1 in 4, as much as 50% of police killings involve someone with a mental health diagnosis. And, you know, when we talk about houselessness and all of those numbers kind of increasing as time goes on, it becomes even more important to develop a different way of, you know, attending to those needs. Police officers are simply just not equipped to deal with mental health crises. I know for me personally, I went to school with a young man named Chase Hammer, and he was killed by Salem PD. he was killed by Salem PD during a mental health crisis. And, you know, one of the things we've been looking at for the Salem-Kaiser area is the CAHOOTS program. We know what works. You know, we have this information, we know what doesn't work, and it's just really, really important that we start to take a look at, you know, at alternatives to policing, because police are not supposed to be doing this work. This is community work. This is social work. This is helping folks. This is resources. And as we know, and as we've seen time and time and time and time again, when police have contact with folks in mental health crises, oftentimes the results are frankly deadly. And it's become really a huge passion of mine as I've watched, you know, other friends struggle with mental health crisis and watched how the police have responded. I used to work for Valley Mental Health and would have to sometimes contact our mental health mobile crisis unit, and it just simply wasn't enough. They were not trained. Again, we know that we have programs in this country that have been working for long periods of time that can simply do it better. As we look at different avenues to get away from policing or to get away from the type of policing that we're doing now, mobile crisis intervention is the logical next step. It just makes sense to rely on folks that are trauma-informed, that know how to de-escalate, that know harm reduction techniques, that know how to facilitate conflict resolution. All of those things are amazing. And those are all things that legislators are talking about right now. So there are several bills that mention mobile crisis intervention, and those things are kind of being worked out. I think some of those bills are kind of going through some amendment periods or, you know, kind of being looked at in different ways. But this is a conversation that's happening right now, and it is a conversation that should continue to happen until we get mobile crisis services all over the state of Oregon.
This last policy segment that we're going to talk about is around Measure 110. So that makes Oregon the first state in the nation to really transform how our systems respond to drug use and addiction. Andy Coe is the executive director at Partnership for Safety and Justice. He's been engaged in justice policy and law reform efforts for over 30 years. Can you talk about Measure 110 and what it proposes to do?
I'll tell you a little bit about Measure 110, but also I want to set the stage a little bit with the war on drugs, because I think I have a particular way of seeing the war on drugs that I think probably a lot of you share, but maybe don't think about a lot in the course of a day. So Measure 110 is a milestone in ending the war on drugs, right? We have a paradigm shift that we're putting in place here in Oregon, and this will come in a little bit later in the few minutes that I have to talk with you about this. We have taken drug users, you know, at least the vast majority of drug users, take them out of the criminal justice system. There still is a violation for it, but it's not a criminal violation, and radically created a funding system for treatment and recovery services and harm reduction and overdose prevention and other harm reduction programs in Oregon that will now be the primary way we address drug use. And so in some ways, when I think about it, we're actually now doing the work that was necessary to do what the drug warriors have been telling us for years, for decades, was the reason why we are criminalizing so many people in this country, disproportionately people of color. It was because we wanted to stop addiction, because we didn't want to have the impact on the families. It was because we didn't want to have people have their lives ruined by their addiction, things that are very real. If that was the goal of the war on drugs, it was an amazing failure, except in the sense of a public relations sort of a messaging system. You know, it's really interesting to me that the history of the war on drugs is about a century old, right? We had a situation where it started explicitly a racist attempt to control people of color. Asian Americans around opium, Mexican Americans around marijuana, Black Americans around cocaine. It was something that was explicitly decades and decades ago about race. That wasn't playing anymore, so they started talking about health. And so the vast majority of people who use drugs and are addicted to drugs do not commit other crimes. So the stigma that we had to heap on them, the ways in which we had to dehumanize them were necessary to be able to treat them the way that we have treated them under the war on drugs. So I think of the war on drugs as a hook, right? The criminalization of people as a hook. You know, in the course of some marijuana reform work, I was sort of debating in a bit of an endorsement, newspaper endorsement context, the city attorney of Seattle. And one of the things, when he was backed up by one of the questions, he was backed up into a corner and he was asked, you know, you don't seem very against this, but at the same time, you still oppose this marijuana initiative. It was a Seattle marijuana initiative. And his response was, sometimes it's the only way we can get the bad guys. So think about that for a second. What he was saying was, sometimes we can't actually do anything. We can't prove that somebody is doing anything wrong, but we still want to get them, so we get them on a drug charge. It is corrupt beyond imagination, and it's used in racist ways, and it's used to oppress, and it has led to all kinds of harms, including mass incarceration, racial disparities, stigmatization that affects people for their whole lives, as well as a barrier to health, because we've actually used that as a way to siphon resources away from the health system so that the criminal justice system could do all the damage that it has done over the years. So Senate Bill 755, we passed Measure 110 in November. Why are we actually tinkering with it now in the legislature? And the answer to that is ballot measures are blunt instruments in some ways. You know, you can't have the kind of debate around detail that you would have around something as technically difficult, as transformative, sort of sea change. You know, there are things that have to be taken out of one system, put into the other. There's funding that has to be allocated. That's a huge thing. That's another reason why the legislative body is actually looking at this very carefully. And I think people's thinking has to change. And I think that's been a process of the legislative process as well. That's been a function of the legislative process. With decriminalization of drug users, what's happened there is that people get cited. They get like a ticket, basically, and then they have to answer the ticket. The question has come up, how many tickets do they get? And at a certain point, when do we start charging them with a crime? The answer is no, you don't charge them with a crime. It's no longer a crime. It's no longer a part of the criminal justice system. Drug users have a problem. Sometimes they don't. And we address addiction through the health system. So, you know, it's that type of work, that type of long-term work, and perfecting the ways in which a new policy, a new paradigm actually interacts with the systems that we have. That's a lot of work. And it started in the legislature this year. It will continue through next year and likely into the future. There'll be attempts to roll it back. There already have been sort of suggestions to roll it back. But I think right now, the wind's at our backs right now. I think we have to take advantage of it and participate in the process.
You have been listening to Prison Pipeline and a webinar discussion by Partnership for Safety and Justice about criminal justice reform legislation now before the Oregon Legislature. And thank you for listening.